Okay, Cliff, let's have a little history about you. You're going to have to move up a little closer again.
I'll move up closer.
Tell us your birthplace and things that happened in your early life, and then just keep going, and I'll ask questions along the line.
Well, I was born in Vancouver, Washington, and in 1922, to be truthful, and my family was involved in the we owned businesses, but usually business had to do with liquor, speakeasies during Prohibition, a silent movie theater, and my father said the talkies would never last, and we lost the movie theater, and, you know, pool halls and a bowling alley and all this stuff. And my father died young at 53, and I was just preteen, and my mother took what money they had, sold the house, and bought another saloon, and that meant that I was on my own. I got up at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and my mother came home around 3 from the saloon, and she got up in the afternoon, and so we didn't see much of each other. It was just one rule, and I had to write down and leave a piece of paper on the kitchen table if I was going to leave town. Wherever I went, I would write and leave her a note where I was going to be. And that's the way life was for me. I was in trouble a little here and there, but I tried to avoid the major problems because growing up with the saloons, I heard the guys that came in and cried, and they told their sad stories, and I thought to myself, boy, I don't want that to happen to me. And so I was careful not to drive when I had been drinking very much and things like that. But wild living was part of my life. I went to San Francisco and lived in a street gang for several months. And I dropped out of high school after 2 years and went to work. Then came the disaster, World War II. And I wasn't a gung-ho, patriotic character that you know, couldn't wait to get involved in the defense of our country. I was from the street, and I thought I was a little more rational and that kind of thing. But then a friend of mine, he got in some hot water, and he said, let's enlist in the Navy, and so we did. And we had about 3 days until we had to report, so we had a big party in a double garage for at least 2 days of that time. We came down to report for duty in Portland, Oregon. And they took one look at us. We were trying to sober up, for crying out loud. I thought all my life that the word sailor and drunken were hyphenated. I never thought that there was such a thing as a sober sailor. And they were really unhappy, so they sent him to Farragut, Idaho, and me to Chicago, to Great Lakes, for our boot camp. He wanted to separate us instantly. I went for a few weeks in Chicago at Wright Junior College, and then they sent me out to San Francisco. And actually out there, it was mostly laboratory work and getting familiar with the equipment and the fleet and whatnot. And the skipper called me in, and I was shocked to be called. And I knew I'd done something wrong. It'd be like being called to the principal's office. And I went to the skippers, and I'm rigid and scared to death. And he says, I hear you don't have to study. And I thought, what in the world's the matter? What did I do wrong now? And he said, looking over your enlistment papers here, he says you were a lifeguard and you were a ham. And he said, looks like you might remember numbers real well. That gave me a relief. And I said, oh, yes. I said, usually when I give a written exam, I said, I can tell you what page number the question the professor took it from. And I kind of relaxed. And he says, that's what I thought. You remember numbers real well. And I said, oh, yes. And he said, well, take 2 steps forward. I need a volunteer. God immediately jerked me out of the school, and I went to a laboratory. But I think it was about a week before, while they were doing the security, because I didn't realize how high security this was going to be. And they called me in and they said, your brothers you listed as Chester, Charlie, and Burton. I said, yes. Said, Chester's not your brother. And I said, what do you mean he's not my brother, you know? And they said, well, your mother was married before. What about him? I said, I never even heard about it. They never even told me anything. As far as I knew, he was Chester Baker. And they said, no, definitely not. Was his name White or DeWitt? I said, I don't know anything about it. How am I going to answer it, you know? So I wrote to my mother, and she said, oh, they were here at the house to interview, and they raised and came because I married a German, a soldier in the United States Army, a sergeant, who was born in Germany. And my mother told me that whether his name was DeWitt or White, I don't remember, but it was one or the other, and he was a 18-year-old in a bar in Texas and got an argument with another young guy and stood up and they drew and he shot and killed the mayor's son. He realized what he'd done. Out the door he went, looked for the biggest horse he could find, the best looking one, and away he rode. Never stopped until he got into Idaho, where he eventually met my mother. And then he wrote to his mother and wrote as though it was her sister, so that they wouldn't know where to hunt for him. And they were married, and she was pregnant with my oldest brother when he died of one of the fevers. It wasn't yellow fever, but one of the fevers that was swept through. And then she married my father when my oldest brother was just a year old. And they raised him and never intended to tell anybody it wasn't his son. And along comes the grandmother on the real father's side. And he was a teenager, and he went off with her to Los Angeles and never lived with us again. But I think it was a shock to him, too. He looked different than the rest of us, and he was real dark-complected. None of us were, and he was sure that there was something in the woodpile. Well, anyway, the Navy was a shocking experience because what they wanted was somebody to swim ashore and with electronic equipment jam the Japanese communications. And my instructions were to wait until there was a lot of communication going on and then jam it intermittently so that you can imagine get a letter in which somebody cut pieces out. I was with a lot of the men who were underwater demolition. I never had any training with the explosives or anything. They just simply were concerned that I could swim from one island to the other and in the Hawaiis and land at the right place. And that was kind of the story. Only I guess the best story is that after Guam, when I swam ashore in Guam, there's a light plane. I don't know what they call it. It looked like a Piper Cub, but wasn't the name of it. Some kind of a grasshopper plane. And they were the observation planes and scouting and this kind of thing. And they would wait until the sun was low, and then they would drop the electronic equipment to me. I just swam ashore with a trailer bag and never had a gun. I just carried a knife, a big K-bar on my leg. And I was kind of a menacing little guy because of the K-bar knife, the combat gear, and no sleeves in my shirt and whatnot. But anyway, I came back from Guam, and out of 200 that were in that assault unit, there were 8 of us. And the old man came along handing out stars. And if you had no combat, why, you got a ribbon and a star. And he came to me, and he stopped, and he looked at me, and he said, they used to call me Sparks because that's what my insignia was on my arm. And he said, Sparks? He said, I didn't expect you to come back. And he didn't quite finish it, but he was saying, I didn't expect you to come back. Then he said, you're Lucky. Well, for 3 years, I had one name, Lucky. Though, of course, that also had to do with the fact that I had my tops and bottoms. If you don't know what tops and bottoms are, the same number is on the opposite side on the dice. So in the two together, you can't make a seven. So you can continue to take their money away slowly and then say, oh, there's somebody coming, and everybody looks to see who's coming. I hear a noise over there. And you tip the top and bottom back in your belt and take the other ones back out, and they look just like them. And then you lose, and you haven't got all their money, but you got most of it. Anyway, I went through the war with my tops and bottoms, but my name was Lucky. That's, everybody called me that. My commander in the Special Forces, they told me that they would leave me enrolled in the school and that I would stay in that school for the rest of the time I was in the Navy, and I would be shipped out, and I would have a blank record which had nothing on it but my name and probably my serial number. But I was in lots of trouble because I didn't really expect to live through it. I just thought that was my life. Like, you know, some guys are born and their dad was a shoemaker and they're going to be a shoemaker. And I was in the Navy and I got picked for this, and that was my life, and I didn't expect to live through it. I had never been to church. And one time I was in the brig. I was in the brig lots of times, but I was in the brig one time, and the skipper said, everybody that's in the brig will go to church this Sunday. They came down and they said, what are you? And I said, I'm an atheist. And he said, no, there's no church for atheists. He said, I'll bet money you don't have an A on your dog tag. And I said, yes, I do, but I didn't. When I enlist, they asked me what I was. What's your religious preference? And I said, I'm an atheist. And he says, there are no atheists. He said, now I'm going to ask you once more. And he asked me a second time when I was enlisting. And I said, no, I said, I'm an atheist. And he said, well, I solved this problem. He says, are you a Jew? And I said, no. Are you a Catholic? And I said, no. And I got a P. And I went through the war with a P on my dog tags because of that.
Meaning?
Years,
yeah. Meaning?
Years ago, when I was a kid, we had one saloon, and there was a gas station, the point of a gas station where two roads came together, and a church right across from it. And I asked first my stepfather, when he was there one Sunday morning, we're cleaning up. Oh, what a mess every Sunday morning. We'd go early in the morning and clean up so that they could open by noon. And I asked him, I said, why do people go to church? And he doubled up his fist and he said, when your left or your right can't take care of you, he says, your fist, he says, then you got to join with them so you got somebody to fight for you. That was his answer. And then Lou came, and he was the head of the syndicate in the Oregon, Washington area there. Lou was there, and he was kind of a friend of mine. And because I was taken out of regular school in the sixth grade and let study in the library, why, I went through differential integral calculus by the eighth grade and just studying the books. They'd bring them one book after another to me, and I'd do all the problems in the book and go tell them I was done and I want another book. And he was convinced that I was going to be an accountant for the syndicate, and I would be handling the money and counting and making the records and all this. And I said to Lou, I said, do you go to church? No. I said, why do people go to church? And he said, well, he said, everybody who belongs to a church, whether it's Jew or Catholic or what, he said, they all give 10% of their money to the church. And he said, I don't give any money, and that makes me an atheist. And I said, boy, that's what I am. I don't give no money to nobody. I'm an atheist, all right. The Navy didn't quite buy that, so I became a Protestant, but I never went to the church. Oh, yeah, that one time, yeah. Yeah, they went to the Marine in the brig, went to back out, and he got another Marine to come in, took off his belt and put his gun belt on the other Marine and said, unlock the door. The other guy unlocked the door, and he came in. We went a round or two, and he beat me up, and I went to church with him, and they kept poking me with a rifle, because they took me under guard, and they kept poking me in the ribs. And for years, I'd tell a story, I'd have to rub my ribs, because it felt like it felt good to rub it when they were poking me, because I'd laugh at what the guy was saying, and I guess I burped and everything. I thought, I'll show them what this is, and they're not going to get 10% of my money. Anyway, that was my first introduction to church, and I don't know what he said at all. But
Where did the turnaround come for you then?
Well, I had a guy. You see, I was first class most of the time. They built me regularly, and then they put me back up because I said, "Oh, I can't be in charge of that. I don't have enough rent." Oh well, you're first class again. Quit talking, you know. And I had a guy. We called him Socks. His last name was Rogers, and he landed at Guadalcanal. He was a little older than I was. He landed at Guadalcanal, and he didn't change his shoes and socks or wash his socks, and he got jungle rot on his feet. And they told him, "You've got to change your socks more often. You've got to make sure your socks are washed and everything." And so when he landed the first time with me, before we landed, when we went through the training, we go through a week, and you crawl under live fire, and you run and all this stuff, and man, that was all great for me. I had run, walked, and lived traveling. And you crawl through the live fire. So when he got through the live fire, took off his shoes, his socks, stuck his bayonet in the ground, washed his socks and his helmet with his water out of his canteen, and hung them on his bayonet to dry, and stood up, ready to go. And his nickname was Socks, of course. And he landed on the beach. And, you know, we had a limited amount of stuff we could take. He'd take 10 pair of socks with him. Oh, God. And so he was Socks Rogers. He was some kind of a religious person. What he was, I do not know. Because when we'd be gambling, playing cards or shooting dice or whatever, he'd be sitting in his bunk reading some books. I don't know what it was all about. It was religious, no question about it. But he never bugged us about it. Never bugged us. He was just religious, and we went out and raised hell, got drunk and got in fights and ended up in the brig, and they'd bring us back in custody and all this kind of stuff. Socks would go out. I don't know. He said something about libraries and museums and stuff. Anyway, we had a game we used to play when we were gambling and together. We used to play "If I Don't Come Back," and you'd say, "If I don't come back," and each different guy would give his what you wanted the others to do. And with me, I said you had to go break the bank in Reno and say this is for Lucky, you know. And one guy said, "Well, you got to save up all you can for a month or two, and you save up this money, and you take out a beautiful blonde, you wear a tweed suit, and you have the biggest time of your life, you know, and say, this was for John, you know." And another guy was from Colorado, Sullivan. And Sully used to say, "Well, if I don't come back, one of these got to be a farmer and say, I'm running this farm for Sully, you know." And, well, after Iwo, that would be Okinawa. At Okinawa, I identified arm and some other things that I thought were, well, I was sure they belonged to Socks. He was blown apart by a mortar shell on Oki. And Okinawa, no. Yeah. Yeah, I confused that with the landing in February, which was Iwo Jima. And in my, when I came, I was there sometimes 3 days before they landed, and then I was there maybe 5 days during the first of the invasion, and I left, you know. They'd evacuate me and fly me back eventually to the staging area. And I just kept coming back, and he just kept saying, "You're lucky," and I kept saying to my captain. I had a captain who was an engineer with RCA, and they brought him in as a four-striper with very minimal instruction in what an officer is supposed to do, because he didn't want nothing to do with the military aspect. But he handled all the communications, and the jamming was part of his responsibility. And I'd come back and cuss him up one side and down the other, and I'd tell him I'm never going to go in there again by myself. See, my grandmother was Oglala Sioux Indian. She was a tribal Indian, born around 1840. And one time when the men were out hunting, because men hunt and fish and women stay and do the work, and we tried to improve on that. That was silly. The Cherokee war party swept in and grabbed up a half a dozen girls, young girls, and they had to hide from the Sioux who hunted for them and never caught them. And they went clear to Missouri, and in Missouri they put them on a stump one after another and sold them as brides to white men who had come to this country to make money, you know, to make their fortune. And an Englishman, J.C. Chamberlain, bought her, and she used to laugh and say, J.C. was a fool, he paid the biggest price for me. That's the way she'd brag. And so my grandmother taught me the Indian ways. I was a boy. My older next brother, older than me, he didn't like her, didn't get along with her, and he never learned any of it, but I did. And my mother then joined in, and when we'd go camping and fishing and things like that, she'd say to me, take the position, you know. And that means you go into what is the prenatal position in our language, and you transport yourself into your mother's arms, you're nursing, and the sun is shining on you. And the idea is that you're a part of nature, and you won't be harmed by an animal. One time, we were out fishing, and I was walking along the creek, and I saw a very small bear, and he squalled when I saw him, looked at him in the eye, and I turned to the right from the movement, and here was the mother bear just scooping out of the water, fishing for big fish. And I knew instantly from my training, I took the nature position. I was in my mother's arms, nursing, and the sun was shining on me. And you remember things afterward, but at the time, it doesn't affect you. And I know that the bear came so close, he brushed by me, but never hit me, or I was nothing. There's nothing fearful about me, nothing aggressive, and I'm just like a stump that's there, part of nature. And the mother bear just ran right by me. So on the islands, when they'd direction find me and send a patrol, I would very often hear them in the distance, and I'd grab everything I had and get into the bush as best I could. I didn't need a lot, because I'd go into the nature position, eyes closed. I was taught that the eyes are a path. And people will say, well, gee, I knew they were staring at me from behind me. How did he know? I don't know. But with the eyes closed, in the nature position, with the very controlled breathing, and in my mother's arms, the sun shining on it, they never found me. Later on, I remember things that were said. And a lot of Japanese officers spoke better English than I did, because I only went 2 years to high school. And although they encouraged me in math and whatnot, they didn't encourage me in English. I didn't continue to take English classes. I read books and wrote reports, and they graded the reports and tried to help me with my grammar and whatnot. So I remember one time, after they were all gone, I remember him saying, the Japanese officer, all right, we know you're right there. I won't let them bayonet you if you'll come out. And if I'd actually been there, it would have scared the heck out of me, and obviously they got me. But it wasn't until an hour and a half later that I remembered it. That's what they said. You don't remember it. One time, see, I never told anybody about the war. Well, Canfield I did, because we knew each other during the war. And I never talked much to anybody. I think I told Fred very little in seminary, but I didn't tell hardly anybody. And most of them thought I'd been in the Marines, and they had some weird stories about me, because I was kind of rough. In seminary, I was known as, when I went back to the 40th reunion, the one thing they remembered about me is I had struck a blow and knocked a boy across the room. And that hadn't happened in 75 years that they knew of. And
well, let's
that's what they remembered.
Let's go back. Where then did you come into the feeling that led you to be both a Christian and later to want to do ministry?
Well, what happened is that when I was ready to go home, after they were finally going to release me seven times, I was ready to go home, and we were in discharge center, and the first thing I found out was that my record was empty. He said, they called me, and the officer said, you came back from the Pacific, and I said, yes, and he said, well, it's blank here. He said, what ship were you on? And, well, I had a general court-martial hanging fire, and I didn't want to tell him that I was a special forces or anything else to do with it. So I named a couple of ships, and that's what he wrote down and dismissed me, and I was overjoyed. And that captain that keeps sending me out, he got it burned up. And I didn't believe that they got all the copies done, but they must have gotten it done because they haven't come back after me all these years now. But I ran into a guy who was being discharged, and he said, listen, we can go up to Tule Lake. There's land available up there. We can, it's for the veterans, and we can claim so many acres of it side by side, and we'll develop it. And once we're developed, he was a farm kind of guy. He said, once it's developed, he says, we can sell it. He says, and you can do anything you want, but we need at least two of us to get together, get a big enough land grant. And I thought about Sullivan, you know, if I don't come back, because I remember when Sullivan got one up inside the helmet, it entered through his temple and did a circle inside of his helmet and just tore the top of his head off. Circle. It ricocheted around in there. Anyway, the different ones, and I thought about, oh, you know, I'm not the one to take a blonde out in a tweed suit and have the biggest weekend ever. And I thought, oh, what am I going to do, you know? What am I going to do? I kept thinking about the different guys and their what if I, because there's only one guy, and I visited him that I know that he landed with me and came back. And I just was bugged by this fact that I had been part of this what if I. And so I went back to Berkeley, and when I summer came, I went up to Portland to visit my mother. She was now retired, and when Saturday night came, she said, well, where are you going tonight? And I said, I'm just going to hang around a little while, and I'm going to go to bed. And she looked at me real strange, and she said, you're not going to the Big Apple? And I said, no. That was a near saloon, and I didn't want to go there. And I said, I'm going to get up in the morning and go to church. And she was so shocked, and she said, you're going to church. I'm going with you. And I said, listen, I can fight my way out. You don't need to go with me. She said, I'm going with you. Do you hear me? So she got up in the morning and was dressed before I even got up and got down there. And I got dressed and came down, and she went to church with me. And I had decided that I was going to go to church once for socks, and I wasn't going to go to some church where nobody knew who I was and think I was one of those goody-goody boys that raised in the church and part of the gang and everything. I'd go to a church where when I was in the fourth grade, the sixth graders picked on me, tried to at least, because I wasn't part of the church. They had a regular gang in a real sense. They hung together, and there was a few of us hung together. We'd sit on sixth, seventh grade. We'd sit out on the front of the grocery store at 10, 11 o'clock at night drinking a half gallon of beer. And some of them would come around. We'd kick them in the tail and tell them, get out of here, you know, you don't belong with us. And so I decided I'd go where they knew who I was, and I'd take the consequences. So my mother and I went into the church, and we saw folding chairs in the back. This was Acreage Community Presbyterian Church. Now it's called Grace Presbyterian Church in Portland. And we went into the back, and we sat down in the folding chairs, and we felt that was the safest place. And I don't know what I told her, but I know my plan was if it got too tough, I'd pick a chair and I'd bust the window out and put her out the window, and I'd bash a few of them with a chair and I'd jump out myself, you know. But I was going to go to church once for socks. And we just, oh. This is July, and although I don't think it was over 70 degrees, we just sweat like anything. Oh, man, the sweater just poured off us. I was mopping my brow and she was mopping hers. And we lasted through the whole thing, and the minister there was a fill-in for the summer, at least for that Sunday, and he had a master's degree. I was waiting for him to finish, and I was going to make for the door before I had to fight everything. And So he came down the aisle giving the benediction with his arms stretched out and the two short sleeves of the master's robe flapping. He looked like the devil himself in that black robe flapping, coming down the aisle. Oh, frightening that was. And he no sooner got by us, still saying in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and whatnot, than the people jumped up, headed for the door, and blocked us off. I didn't know if there was another door or anything else, and so I kept moving chairs around to make a barrier, and some of the men came and even reached for me to grab me. Oh, yeah, they were trying to shake my hand, I think. And I kept moving around, moving chairs around, my mother too, and all of a sudden she said, open, and she took off and darted through the group that gathered at the door. We could see out, and she got out, and I ran out, but I was had to make a little more detour than her, and she got quite a lead on me. And I got out the door and down the steps, and I'm headed right towards the old saloon, but down those steps and a long walk out where you meet the street that the gas station was on. And I was probably halfway down there, and here's a voice. Cliff! Cliff Baker! Cliff! I stopped. I said, somebody in the church? Well, out here we can fight good. So I turn around, and it's Conrad Brassett. He grew up there, and he used to try and come around and get us to share our beer with him and stuff when we were in the sixth grade and so forth, and we always run him off. And he was the only guy I ever saw during the whole war that I ever knew before the war. All the Pacific campaign, never saw anybody I'd ever known before, except Conrad. And I ran into him in the mess hall on Guam. I was flying back to Iroquois Point in my staging area in Hawaii. And sometimes you'd get into Guam and you'd lay there for 2 days before they could find space for you, because although it was important to get me out of the front lines, it wasn't important enough to get me back home that instantly, you know, back to my staging area. And so I went through the mess line, and there was about 8 lines there, and I went through one line, a different line over there. He was serving the cake. And he hollered at me, Cliff Baker, Cliff Baker, it's Conrad. And so I put my tray down and pushed my way through everybody, and they took one look at those combat stuff with a big K-bar knife on my leg, and they all gave me room. And I went over there and I said, what are you doing here? You know, probably swore naturally. And he told me that this was his duty. He was working in the mess hall. And I said, well, we'll have to get together after supper. And he says, oh, I have to work until about 10 o'clock at night. He said, I got a lot of responsibility, or a lot of duty anyway. And I said, oh, yeah. So I went back and I ate whatever I had and chucked it. And I went to some guy and I grabbed him and I said, who's in charge here? He looked at me with big eyes. He said, he's outside in the little shack out in the back. I said, all right. I went out, knocked the door. Guy said, who is it? I said, told him my name and serial number. He said, come in. I came in and he was a grumpy character. And I told him that this is the guy, the only one I'd ever seen. And he says, what are you, Army, Navy, Marines? I said, U.S. Navy. He said, what are you? And I said, I'll tell you one thing, and don't ask another question, because this is my instruction, Special Forces. Now, shut up. And he said, well, what do you want? And I said, there's a guy in here I went to school with. I said, I've never seen anybody during the whole war I'd known before. And I said, I want some time with him. And he says, he has to work till 10 o'clock at night. He says, who is it? And I said, Brassett. He said, oh. Oh. He looked at that big K-bar knife, looked at me again. He said, Johnson, Johnson. Some guy pops in instantly and he says, go tell Brassett, take 2 days off. So Conrad and I got to sit on the bank, and he told me about the kids that I had been in grade school with and about the old neighborhood where that saloon was. And I don't know, it was a very friendly meeting. And here he is calling to me to stop when I'm heading for home to get a bath, I'd sweat so terrible, and then go get drunk. Oh, man, that was my plan. Conrad came running down, and he said, Cliff, I heard you were in town. He said, you don't have wheels. I came up on the bus, and he said, you don't have wheels. He said, listen, I'll pick you up at Christian Endeavors meeting at the river. And he says, I know how you love to swim. You're an old lifeguard. And I said, no, no, I'm going to get drunk, Connie. Don't you think anything else. I said, I'm going home, get a bath. I'm going to get drunk. He said, I'll be by to pick you up. And I said, don't waste your time. I'll see you some other time. And I walked on down to the house, about four blocks. And I walked on down to the house. My mother had just gotten a bath and come out. I went in, got a bath. When I came out wrapped in a towel, Conrad was sitting there in the front room. And he said, oh, we'll pick up some buns and hot dogs, and we can take them. It's a kind of a potluck affair. He says, you can swim and we'll have a great time. And I thought, well, it's not at the church, all right. So I went with him. And they were some of the kids that I might have known. Occasionally some of them were. And it ran all the way from the teenagers through those in the first year or two of college. And it was a big group. There was about 50 kids there in the group. And we had our potluck picnic and everything. It was time to go, and I'm with Connie. And Connie says, well, we're going back now. We have our regular meeting Sunday night. And I said, well, I don't want to go. And he says, oh, come on. He says, what else you got to do? He says, you don't want to go get drunk tonight. It is Sunday. And I said, oh, baloney. Anyway, went back there. And on the way, I told him, you know, if the men are here, they'll probably jump me. And he didn't understand it at all. We were in two different worlds. He's trying to tell me about the Christian Endeavor, and I'm trying to tell him about the men and the gang that's going to take me on. And we didn't know each other. Well, something happened there. No, not a great thing. Not a great religious experience. No. I'm sure it was Iwo Jima. Once I came back through the line and joined those on the beach for a day or two during the worst of the early assault, why, they'd come down sometimes from the medical unit and ask if anybody that could help. Well, if I had everything going, I would often go help them. They taught me to shoot morphine sulfate into those waiting in line. And they taught me about triage. This one won't live, you know. This one probably will, but we'll give him MS to relax him. If he wants it again, give it to him again, you know. And here was a guy, and he'd been gut shot, and he's when he breathed or talked, he was bubbling blood. And I was just going to shoot him, and these guys there, and he said, you guys pray for me. But popping blood bubbles when he said it, you know. And we kind of looked at each other, you know. We were not chaplains I don't think it was a chaplain on the beach. And we looked at each other, and this one guy says, you pray for him. Lucky, you always have the words. And I didn't even know what the word pray meant. Pray, as far as I was concerned, was somebody who waited for somebody and prayed on them and got their money. And I said, boy, I didn't know. And that really bothered me. The guy died right there within a minute or two. And that really bothered me. I didn't know what to do. And so I went back and I got one of the books that you get in your pack. And I knew in the back of it there was something in there. And here was a prayer in there. It said it was a prayer. And at the bottom, Franklin Roosevelt's name was signed at the last page of the book. And so I memorized Franklin Roosevelt's prayer. In those days, if I read something twice, I could remember it for 3 months. Literally remember it for 3 months, no problem at all. And so I'm here at the Christian Endeavor meeting, and they complaining about their family at home and how they're mistreated and what went on at school and what goes on. They're working a little bit, and they get in trouble here and there and all this, and they're comforting each other, and they go into this prayer, and they start going around the room, and I could see it going down the aisle. Down the other aisle. This is about 40, 50 kids. And I know it's coming towards me. And I thought, oh, I got it. So when it came to me, I started Franklin D. Roosevelt's prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven. I was shocked. They all joined in. They knew Franklin Roosevelt's prayer. And once again, confusion. When afterwards, I said to him, where did you learn Franklin Roosevelt's prayer? You weren't in the military, you know. They didn't know what I was talking about. They thought I was ending it by the Lord's Prayer. The time was up. Well, I never got through to Conrad. He never got through to me. But he did make me promise that if I stayed for the week, that I would come to the young adults class. And I had to go. I had to go. I had to do this for Sox. I had to find out what he had that I admired. And so I went to the young adults class, and I really enjoyed what they were talking about, the Bible and stuff. I never heard about any of it before. And when anybody grabbed me by the shirt and said, "Are you saved, brother?" Why he got a cut lip and on his tail then, I'll tell you. And whenever accidentally I hit something on the radio, it was all that baloney. I thought they were all just after your money, and that's all. It was just a con game. And so I went once or twice to the young adults class on Sunday morning. I listened to the preacher, and I listened to what he said. I thought, my God, he doesn't know what the world's all about. And then I left and went back to Berkeley. And I can't remember what the class was, but I enrolled in a class, and the very first day of the class, or second day of the class, second time we met, he went through the cards. He was kind of fumbling with the cards, the enrollment cards, and he said, "I'm sure that some of you who've enrolled in this class, and this is in a theater-type room, you know, some of you enrolled in this class are not... I do not have the necessary prerequisites." And he said, "If you'll stop by the office, why I'll have a look for you." And he said, "I think you'll know." And I thought, that must be me, and so I'll go to the office. So immediately after that class, I went to his office, found his office, and his secretary said, "Oh, you can't get an appointment with him until next semester." And this was kind of a sign that I was out in left field someplace. And I hung around two or three days more, and I went up and dropped out and went back to Portland. And I no sooner got back to Portland, Connie come to me and says, "They're starting a new college, for there were too many GIs, and they're starting Vanport." He says, "Why don't you go out there with us?" And so I went out with him. I didn't even have a car yet. Well, I went out with him because in Berkeley I didn't need a car. I lived right off of the main drag there, and I'd walk four blocks to the school or two, and four blocks to the math department. So I went out with Conrad, and they were real late enrolling, and I enrolled out there. But that way I started going back to that church. I want to find out about what was in the Bible. I read it, and it was too difficult for me to read it and understand it. Of course, I started in Genesis, and that made no sense at all. And she told me, "Don't start in Genesis. You start with the Gospel of John." And then she gave me books to read after that. And so I continued to go every Sunday morning. And I didn't quit drinking right away. But I had to really taper off on Saturday night so I could be reasonably responsible on Sunday morning. And the minister was an old man who had been reactivated, probably young to me now. He was probably about 70. He retired when he was 65, was probably about 70. And I wasn't there 3 weeks after I came back. And he said, "Well, are you ready to give your life to Christ?" And I looked shocked, and I said, "No, what are you talking about?" I said, "I just want to find out what this is all about." And he kept after me every Sunday. Just about every Sunday, he put his arm around me and say, "Well, are you ready to come forward?" You know, and he gave the altar call periodically. And I never said anything. I just kept going to the class and learning all I could about the Bible, reading it at home and whatnot. And one night, reading it at night, and that's gotta be January 1947. I was up in the bed, and I was reading the Bible, and I just threw the thing on the floor, and I said, "You know, I got to quit reading this damn thing." And I said, "Either that, or I got to accept Jesus as my Savior." And I got up, picked up the Bible, and put it on the bed, and I kneeled there and accepted the Lord as my Savior. And I looked up, and I said, "Sox, I sure they put you back together up there, and you're watching, and I want you to know I did this for you." It wasn't 2 weeks after that the teacher, Ruth Lee, at the young adult class, said, "Clifford, you know that passage in the Bible where God calls to..." He strokes. And he says, he goes into to the priest, and he said he had been left there by his mother to be raised in the house of the priest, anyway, in the Old Testament. Is it Jacob? No. Anyway, Elijah.
Samuel.
Samuel, right. She said, "You know that passage where Samuel, the Lord calls to Samuel and he doesn't recognize it?" Said, "When the Lord calls to you, you say, 'Here am I, Lord.'" And I said, "What are you talking about, the Lord calls to me?" And she said, "You just remember what I said." Well, the old minister was replaced by a younger one, and I went forward, and along with another guy who was a pretty wild customer, and we were baptized, and I accepted the Lord publicly there. But I told him, you know, I accepted him in that bedroom when I kneeled before that bed. And I have written many times, I don't think I ever have been as close to the Lord as I was that night. And I've had some arguments with some Christians who think that they accepted the Lord and 10 years later they were closer to the Lord. And I don't know about that. I can only say for myself how it was. So I accepted the Lord and became relatively active in that church. And went off to Corvallis to seminary to college, and while I was there, I met the woman that's been my wife for 52 years, and I said, "The Lord has given me a sign," because the things I had written a paper on differential equations and cryptography and because I used to service the cryptography machines. My security was so high, they told me that I couldn't leave the United States for 10 years after I got out. And the head of the math department got me an interview, and he said, I told him I wasn't interested in a government job, and he said, "Well, take the interview anyway, because it's good experience for you." And so I went to Portland from Corvallis to the Benson Hotel, where I met somebody from cryptography back in Maryland. And he told me about the paper, and he says, "I can't give it back to you because some of the things you've written in there are really classified, that information." And he wanted me to enroll and go to the cryptography school. And I told him, "I didn't want nothing to do with the Army. I didn't want to do with the military or the government. You know, I just wanted out of the whole thing." And he kind of threatened me, in as much as he said, "Well, if you get drafted by mistake," he said, "then we'll give you another opportunity." And I told him I wasn't married, and he said, "Oh." And I asked him about the guy that was in the room with us, because I was used to the hoodlums, the syndicate, and they'd have their suits tailored so you couldn't see the .357 they carried under their arm. And this guy's suit was tailored because one side was different than the other. And I told him, I said, "What's that guy?" He said, "He's my bodyguard." He said, there's four or five of them, and there's one of them with me every day, 24 hours a day. And that was frightening. I said, "I'm not even married." I said, "I would find a wife that could tolerate." Oh, he says, "They can tolerate that. You're out of your mind." Oh, I don't know. I had chances with the Aramco oil company, and oh, I had all kinds of offers and opportunities, and yet the one thing I had to do is I had to go to seminary. And it, by that time, it wasn't for socks. It was because I had to go. So after I met and was engaged to the woman that I married, I told her, "Before you marry me, you got to realize I may go to seminary," and she was overjoyed. And that's kind of the story of how I came to be a Christian, and And
can you pull off maybe one or two? I'm going to be running out of tape soon. A couple of experiences from the Christian faith. How many years you were pastoring? You still are. I can't say that anymore.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't a pastor. I was an evangelist. I was ordained an evangelist because I went to work for the Board of National Missions. I interviewed at a big church in Portland as a youth to be a youth minister, and one of the elders took me aside and said, "I know about you, and I'll vote against you. You haven't got a chance." That was great because Earl Jackman, Sunday School Missions, was after me from the time I knocked that guy across the room there in that special class. He met me and he'd say, "You're my kind of man," and he sent me out and I went to Big Bend, California, and I covered a territory of logging camps and sawmill towns and construction sites, and probably one of the funniest is the sawmill town. I mean, the logging camps were, in those days they worked 10 days a week and had 4 days off. And during the time when there was a demand, why they were trying to con them into working another 2 days and take 2 days off, no women were allowed to live in the camp, and the camp was on skids. They moved it in closer and closer. And I used to go, and I actually corresponded by mail with these people, and set the date that I'd be there, and I'd have a church service for them. I would come early enough in the afternoon to eat dinner with them. Well, I should say this. When they came from the woods into Crummy, that's a big station wagon, they come out of there and they're just dirty as everything. Just faces and hands and their bodies are dirty. And immediately the Christians would gather with me, bow their heads, we'd have a word of prayer, and then they'd run and get washed up for supper. And I'd go into the mess building. And the young, strong ones would eat quick. Then they'd go hold the doors and force everybody to stay while I preached. And there was some fighting went on at the doors, and this was part of the routine. And the next thing, things would be pretty well over and done, and I'd get up on the table, and one of the tables we ate at, I'd get up on the table we ate at. And I found out that the hymn books were worthless, but I had mimeographed the gospel songs, and we used to sing the gospel song. Then I'd preach about 10 minutes. But the problem was, I'd get up on that table, and very often would come the challenge. One guy would get up and say, "Fight or run, preacher." And he'd put your book down, you'd jump down, you'd go around with him, and he held his punch. He didn't really hit me hard, I know that, you know, and he'd take some good licks from me, I thought. And they'd say, that's enough. He's man enough to fight, he's man enough to preach. And so I'd get up and I'd have this very short service we actually had. We sang about 5 or 6 minutes, and I preached about 10 minutes. I read the Bible, and we prayed, and I gave the altar call. And very frequently I had somebody come up with problems. It wasn't necessarily that you had to accept Jesus as your Savior. I dealt with problems and counseled them at the same time. But I had a lot of conversions as well. And one time that I got up on the table, a guy got up and he took a couple of pulls from a pint that he had in his hip, and he said, "Fight or run, preacher." He meant it. He came down front to go, and I'll tell you, he was a go. But there was a new cook there. Great, huge woman, probably weighed 350 at least. She jumped up, grabbed him by the shirt, butted him with her head, and just knocked him silly. Then she pushed some of the guys off the front bench there and set him down and held on to him and said, "Now, Harry, you need to know the Lord, and today is your day." Well, I went ahead, got up on the thing. I was mad because she got involved. I thought they'd think I wasn't a man if a woman fought for me. I went through and gave a little short speech and a sermon and the prayer, and I called for anybody who wanted to accept Jesus or wanted to be prayed for, come forward. And she threw him forward, and he kneeled. I was shocked. So I came to him. It was about three of them that night. I came to him and I said, "What do you want?" And he said, "I want to know the Lord." I laid my hands on him and prayed for him, prayed for the power of the Holy Spirit to enter him. And he shouted hallelujah and whatnot. And I thought, he must have had a Pentecostal background or something. Never thought too much about it. Next time I came back to that camp, who's there running off from the things over there, bowing his head to be in the prayer? Who's there at the door ready to fight to keep the rest of them, make them stay? Him. Yep, him. Yeah.